the cat's head, scratching under the collar. I need to know. I need to know so much. Mogget purred under the scratching, but as Sabriel leaned close, she could hear the faint peal of the tiny Saraneth bell cut through the purr, and she was reminded that Mogget was no cat, but a free magic creature. For a moment Sabriel wondered what Mogget's true shape was, and his true nature.
I am the servant of Abhorsen, Mogget said at last, and you are Abhorsen, so I must help you. But you must promise me that you will not raise your father if his body is dead. Truly, he would not wish it. I cannot promise, but I will not act without much thought, and I will listen to you if you are by me. I guessed as much, Mogget said, twisting his head away from Sabriel's hand. It is true that you are sadly ignorant, or you would promise with a will. Your father should never have sent you beyond the wall.
Why did he? Asked Sabriel, her heart suddenly leaping with the question that had been with her all her schooldays, a question Abhorsen had always smiled away with the one word, necessity.
He was afraid, replied Mogget, turning his attention back to the fish. You were safer in Anselstier.
What was he afraid of?
Eat your fish, replied Mogget,
as two sendings appeared from the kitchen, bearing what was obviously the next course.
We'll talk later, in the study.
Chapter 9. Lanterns lit the study, old brass lanterns that burned with charter magic in place of oil. Smokeless, silent, and eternal, they provided as good a light as the electric bulbs of Anselstier. Books lined the walls, following the curves of the tower around, save for where the stair rose from below, and the ladder climbed to the observatory above. A redwood table sat in the middle of the room, its legs scaled and beady-eyed, ornamental flames licking from the mouths of the dragon heads that gripped each corner of the tabletop. An inkwell, pens, papers, and a pair of bronze map dividers lay upon the table. Chairs of the same red wood surrounded it, their upholstery black with a variation on the silver key motif. The table was one of the few things Sabriel remembered from her childhood visits. Dragon desk, her father had called it, and she'd wrapped herself around one of those dragon legs, her head not even reaching the underside of the table. Sabriel ran her hand over the smooth, cool wood, feeling both her memory of it and the current sensation. Then she sighed, pulled up a chair, and put down the three books she tucked under her arm. Two she put together close to her, the other she pushed to the center of the table. This third book came from the single, glassed-in cabinet among the bookshelves, and now lay like some quiescent predator, possibly asleep, possibly waiting to spring. Its binding was of pale green leather, and charter marks burned in the silver clasps that held it closed. The Book of the Dead. The other two books were normal enough by comparison. Both were charter magic spell books, listing mark after mark and how they could be used. Sabriel didn't even recognize most of the marks after chapter 4 in the first book. There were 20 chapters in each volume. Doubtless there were many other books that would be useful, Sabriel thought, but she still felt too tired and shaky to get more down. She planned to talk to Mogget, then study for an hour or two before going back to bed. Even 4 or 5 waking hours seemed too much after her ordeal, and the loss of consciousness involved in sleep suddenly seemed very appealing. Mogget, as if he had heard Sabriel thinking of him, appeared at the top of the steps and sauntered over to sprawl on a well-upholstered footstand.
I see you have found that book, he said, tail flicking backwards and forwards as he spoke. Take care you do not read too much.
I've already read it all anyway, replied Sabriel shortly.
Perhaps, remarked the cat, but it isn't always the same book. Like me, it is several things, not one.
Sabriel shrugged, as if to show that she knew all about the book, but that was just bravado. The inner Sabriel was afraid of the Book of the Dead. She had worked her way through every chapter under her father's direction, but her normally excellent memory held only selected pages of this tome. If it changed its contents as well, she suppressed a shiver and told herself that she knew all that was necessary.
"My first step must be to find my father's body," she said, "which is where I need your help, Mogget." "I have no knowledge of where he met his end," Mogget stated, with finality.
He yawned and started licking his paws. Sabriel frowned and found herself pulling in her lips, a characteristic she had deplored in the unpopular history teacher at school, who often went thin-lipped in anger or exasperation.
"Just tell me when you last saw him and what his plans were." "Why don't you read his diary?" suggested Mogget, in a momentary break from cleaning himself.
"Where is it?"
asked Sabriel, excited. A diary would be tremendously helpful.
"He probably took it with him," replied Mogget. "I haven't seen it."
"I thought you had to help me," Sabriel said,
another frown wrinkling across her forehead, reinforcing the thin lips.
"Please answer my question."
3 weeks ago,"
Mogget mumbled, mouth half muffled in the fur of his stomach, pink tongue alternating between words and cleansing.
"A messenger came from Belisaire, begging for his help. Something dead, something that could pass the wards, was preying on them. The previous Abhorsen, ma'am, suspected that there was more to it than that, Belisaire being Belisaire. But he went."
"Belisaire? The name's familiar. It's a town?"
"A city. The capital. At least it was, when there was still a kingdom."
"Was?" Mogget stopped washing and looked across, eyes narrowing to frowning slits.
"What did they teach you in that school? There hasn't been a king or queen for 200 years, and not even a regent for 20. That's why the kingdom sinks day by day into a darkness from which no one will rise."
"The charter," Sabriel began, but Mogget interrupted with a yowl of derision.
"The charter crumbles too," he mewed. "Without a ruler, charter stones broken one by one with blood, one of the great charters twisted.
"What do you mean, one of the great charters?" Sabriel interrupted in turn. She had never heard of such a thing. Not for the first time, she also wondered what she'd been taught in school, and why her father had kept so quiet about the state of the old kingdom. But Mogget was silent, as if the things he'd already said had stopped his mouth. For a moment he seemed to be trying to form words, but nothing came from his small red mouth. Finally he gave up.
"I cannot tell you. It's part of my binding, curse it. Suffice it to say that the whole world slides into evil, and many are helping the slide."
"And others resist it," said Sabriel. "Like my father, like me."
"It depends what you do," Mogget said,
as if he doubted that someone as patently useless as Sabriel would make much difference.
"Not that I care."
The sound of the trapdoor opening above their heads stopped the cat in mid-speech. Sabriel tensed, looking up to see what was coming down the ladder, then started breathing again, as she realized that it was only another charter sending, its black habit flopping over the rungs of the ladder as it came down. This one, like the guards on the cliff corridor, but unlike the other house servants, had the silver key emblazoned on its chest and back. It bowed to Sabriel and pointed up. With a feeling of foreboding, Sabriel knew that it wanted her to look at something from the observatory. Reluctantly, she pushed her chair back and went over to the ladder. A cold draft was blowing in through the open trap door, carrying with it the chill of ice from further up the river. Sabriel shivered as her hands touched the cold metal rungs. Emerging into the observatory, the chill passed, for the room was still lit by the last red light of the setting sun, giving an illusion of warmth and making Sabriel squint. She had no memory of this room, so it was with delight that she saw that it was totally walled in glass, or something like it. The bare beams of the red-tiled roof rested on transparent walls, so cleverly mortised together that the roof was like a work of art, complete with a slight draft that reduced its perfection to a more human level. A large telescope of gleaming glass and bronze dominated the observatory, standing triumphant on a tripod of dark wood and darker iron. A tall observer's stool stood next to it, and a lectern, a star chart, still spilled across it. A thick, toe-wriggle-inviting carpet lay under all, a carpet that was also a map of the heavens, showing many different colourful constellations and whirling planets, woven in thick, richly dyed wool. The sending, who had followed Sabriel, went to the south wall and pointed out towards the southern riverbank, its pallid, charter-drawn hand indicating the very spot where Sabriel had emerged after her underground flight from the Mordicant. Sabriel looked there, shielding her right eye from the west-falling sun. Her gaze crossed the white tops of the river and was drawn to the ledge, despite an inner quailing about what she would see. As she feared, the Mordicant was still there, but with what she had come to think of as her death sight, Sabriel sensed it was quiescent, temporarily just an unpleasant statue, a foreground to other, more active shapes that bustled about in some activity behind. Sabriel stared a little longer, then went to the telescope, narrowly avoiding Mogget, who had somehow appeared underfoot. Sabriel wondered how he had got up the ladder, then dismissed the thought as she concentrated on what was happening outside. Unaided, she hadn't been certain what the shapes around the Mordicant were, but they sprang sharply at her through the telescope, drawn so close she felt she could somehow lean forward and snatch them away. They were men and women, living, breathing people. Each was shackled to a partner's leg by an iron chain, and they shuffled about in these pairs under the dominating presence of the Mordicant. There were scores of them, coming out of the corridor, carrying heavily laden leather buckets or lengths of timber, taking them across the ledge and down the steps to the river. Then they filed back again, buckets empty, timber left behind. Sabriel depressed the telescope a little and almost growled in exasperation and anger as she saw the scene by the river. More living slaves were hammering long boxes together from the timber, and these boxes were being filled with earth from the buckets. As each box was filled, it was pushed out to bridge the gap from shore to stepping stone, and locked in place by slaves hammering iron spikes into the stone. This particular part of the operation was being directed by something that lurked well back from the river, halfway up the steps, a man-shaped blot of blackest night, a moving silhouette. A necromancer's shadow hand, or some free-willed dead spirit that scorned the use of a body. As Sabriel watched, the last of four boxes was thrust out to the first stepping stone, spiked in place, and then chained to its three adjacent fellows. One slave, fastening the chain, overbalanced and went headfirst into the water, his shacklemate following a second later. Their screams, if any, were drowned by the roar of the waterfall as its waters took their bodies. A few seconds later, Sabriel felt their lives snuffed out. The other slaves at the river's edge stopped working for a moment, either shocked at the sudden loss, or momentarily made more afraid of the river than their masters. But the shadow hand on the steps moved towards them, its legs like treacle, pouring down the slope, lapping over each step in turn. It gestured for some of the nearer slaves to walk across the earth-filled boxes to the stepping stone. They did so, to cluster unhappily amid the spray. The shadow hand hesitated then, but the Mordicant on the ledge above seemed to stir and rock forward a little, So the shadowy abomination gingerly trod on the boxes and walked across to the stepping stone, taking no scathe from the running water.
"Grave dirt,"
commented Mogget, who obviously didn't need the telescope.
"Carted up by the villagers from Choir and Robelstown. I wonder if they got enough to cross all the stones."
"Grave dirt," commented Sabriel bleakly, watching a fresh round of slaves arriving with buckets and more timber.
"I had forgotten it could negate the running water. I thought I would be safe here for a time."
"Well, you are," said Mogget. "It'll take at least until tomorrow evening before their bridge is complete, particularly allowing for a couple of hours off around noon, when the dead will have to hide if it isn't overcast. But this shows planning, and that means a leader. Still, every Abhorson has enemies. It may just be a petty necromancer with a better brain for strategy than most."
"I slew a dead thing at Cloven Crest," Sabriel said slowly, thinking aloud. "It said it would have its revenge, and spoke of telling the servants of Kerrigor. Do you know that name?"
"I know it," spat Mogget, tail quivering straight out behind him. "But I cannot speak of it, except to say it is one of the great dead, and your father's most terrible enemy. Do not say it lives again."
"I don't know," replied Sabriel, looking down at the cat, whose body seemed twisted, as if in turmoil between command and resistance. "Why can't you tell me more? The binding?"
A perversion of the yes,
Mogget croaked out with effort. Though his green eyes seemed to grow luminous and fiery with anger at his own feeble explanation, he could say no more.
"Coils within coils," remarked Sabriel thoughtfully. There seemed little doubt that some evil power was working against her, from the moment she'd crossed the wall, or even before that, if her father's disappearance was anything to go by.
She looked back through the telescope again, and took some heart in the slowing of the work as the last light faded, though at the same time she felt a pang of sympathy for the poor people the dead had enslaved. Many would probably freeze to death, or die of exhaustion, only to be brought back as dull-witted hands. Only those who went over the waterfall would escape that fate. Truly, the Old Kingdom was a terrible place, when even death did not mean an end to slavery and despair.
"Is there another way out?" she asked,
swiveling the telescope around 180 degrees to look at the northern bank. There were stepping stones going there, too, and another door high on the river bank, but there were also dark shapes clustered on the ledge by the door. 4 or 5 shadow hands, too many for Sabriel to fight through alone.
"It seems not," she answered herself grimly. "What of defences, then? Can the Sendings fight?"
"The Sendings don't need to fight," replied Mogget, "for there is another defence, though it is a rather constrictive one. And there is one other way out, though you probably won't like it."
The Sending next to her nodded, and pantomimed something with its arm that looked like a snake wiggling through grass.
"What's that?" asked Sabriel, fighting back a sudden urge to break into hysterical laughter. "The defence, or the way out?"
"The defence," replied Mogget. "The river itself. It can be invoked to rise almost to the height of the island walls, 4 times your height above the stepping stones. Nothing can pass such a flood, in or out, till it subsides in a matter of weeks."
"So how would I get out?" asked Sabriel. "I can't wait weeks."
"One of your ancestors built a flying device. A paper wing, she called it. You can use that. Launched out over the waterfall."
"Oh," said Sabriel, in a little voice.
"If you do wish to raise the river,"
Mogget continued, as if he hadn't noticed Sabriel's sudden silence,
Then we must begin the ritual immediately. The flood comes from Meltwater, and the mountains are many leagues upstream. If we call the waters now, the flood will be on us by dusk tomorrow.
Chapter 10. The arrival of the floodwaters was heralded by great chunks of ice that came battering against the wooden bridge of grave dirt boxes like storm-borne icebergs ramming anchored ships. Ice shattered, wood splintered, a regular drumming that beat out a warning, announcing the great wave that followed the outriding ice. Dead hands and living slaves scurried back along the coffin bridge, the dead's shadowy bodies losing shape as they ran, so they became like long, thick worms of black crepe, squirming and sliding over rocks and boxes, throwing human slaves aside without mercy, desperate to escape the destruction that came roaring down the river. Sabriel, watching from the tower, felt the people die, convulsively swallowing as she sensed their last breaths gurgling, sucking water instead of air. Some of them, at least two pairs, had deliberately thrown themselves into the river, choosing a final death rather than risk eternal bondage. Most had been knocked, pushed, or simply scared aside by the dead. The wave front of the flood came swiftly after the ice, shouting as it came, a higher, fiercer roar than the deep bellow of the waterfall. Sabriel heard it for several seconds before it rounded the last bend of the river. Then suddenly it was almost upon her, a huge vertical wall of water with chunks of ice on its crest like marble battlements and all the debris of 400 miles swilling about in its muddy body. It looked enormous, far taller than the island's walls, taller even than the tower where Sabriel stared, shocked at the power she had unleashed, a power she had hardly dreamed possible when she'd summoned it the night before. It had been a simple enough summoning. Mogget had taken her to the cellar, and then down a winding, narrow stair that grew colder and colder as they descended. Finally, they reached a strange grotto, where icicles hung, and Sabriel's breath blew clouds of white, but it was no longer cold, or perhaps so cold she no longer felt it. A block of pure blue-white ice stood upon a stone pedestal, both limned with charter marks, marks strange and beautiful. Then, following Mogget's instruction, she'd simply placed her hand on the ice and said, "Our Porson pays her respects to the Clare and requests the gift of water." That was all. They'd gone back up the stairs, ascending locked the cellar door behind them, and another brought Sabriel a nightshirt and a cup of hot chocolate. But that simple ceremony had summoned something that seemed totally out of control. Sabriel watched the wave racing towards them, trying to calm herself, but her breath raced in and out as quickly as her stomach flipped over. Just as the wave hit, she screamed and ducked under the telescope. The whole tower shook, stones screeching as they moved, and for a moment even the sound of the waterfall was lost in a crack that sounded as if the island had been leveled by the first shock of the wave. But after a few seconds, the floor stopped shaking, and the crash of the flood subsided to a controlled roar, like a shouting drunk made aware of company. Sabriel hauled herself up the tripod and opened her eyes. The walls had held, and though now the wave was past, the river still raged a mere handspan below the island's defences, and was almost up to the tunnel doors on either bank. There was no sign of the stepping stones, the coffin bridge, the dead, or any people, just a wide, brown, rushing torrent, carrying debris of all descriptions. Trees, bushes, parts of buildings, livestock, chunks of ice. The flood had claimed its tribute from every riverbank for hundreds of miles. Sabriel looked at this evidence of destruction, and inwardly counted the number of villagers who had died on the grave boxes. Who knew how many other lives had been lost, or livelihoods threatened upstream? Part of her tried to rationalize her use of the flood, telling her that she had to do it in order to fight on against the dead, Another part said she had simply summoned the flood to save herself. Mogget had no time for such introspection, mourning, or pangs of responsibility. He left her watching, blank-eyed, for no more than a minute, before padding forward and delicately inserting his claws in Sabriel's slippered foot.
"Ow! What did you—" "There's no time to waste sightseeing," Mogget said. "The Sendings are readying the paper wing on the eastern wall, and your clothing and gear have been ready for at least half an hour."
"I've got all—" Sabriel began. Then she remembered that her pack and skis lay at the bottom end of the entrance tunnel, probably as a pile of mordicant burned ash.
"The Sendings have got everything you'll need, and a few things you won't, knowing them. You can get dressed, pack up, and head off for Belisaire." "I take it you intend to go to Belisaire."
"Yes," replied Sabriel shortly. She could detect a tone of smugness in Mogget's voice.
"Do you know how to get there?"
Sabriel was silent. Mogget already knew the answer was no, hence the smugness.
"Do you have a,
map?" Sabriel shook her head, clenching her fists as she did so, resisting the urge to lean forward and spank Mogget, or perhaps give his tail a judicious tug. She had searched the study and asked several of the Sendings, but the only map in the house seemed to be the star map in the tower. The map Colonel Horrees had told her about must still be with Abhorsen. With Father, Sabriel thought, suddenly confused about their identities. If she was now Abhorsen, who was her father? Had he too once had a name that was lost in the responsibility of being Abhorsen? Everything that had seemed so certain and solid in her life a few days ago was crumbling. She didn't even know who she was, really, and trouble seemed to beset her from all sides. Even a supposed servant of Abhorsen like Mogget seemed to provide more trouble than service.
"Do you have anything positive to say? Anything that might actually help?" she snapped.
Mogget yawned, showing a pink tongue that seemed to contain the very essence of scorn.
"Well, yes, of course. I know the way, so I'd better come with you."
"Come with me?" Sabriel asked, genuinely surprised. She unclenched her fists, bent down, and scratched between the cat's ears, till he ducked away.
"Someone has to look after you," Mogget added, "at least till you've grown into a real Abhorsen."
"Thank you," said Sabriel, "I think. But I would still like a map. Since you know the country so well, would it be possible for you to, I don't know, describe it, so I can make a sketch map or something?" Mogget coughed, as if a hairball had suddenly lodged in his throat, and thrust his head back a little.
"You draw a sketch map? If you must have one, I think it would be better if I undertook the cartography myself. Come down to the study and put out an inkwell and paper."
"As long as I get a usable map, I don't care who draws it," Sabriel remarked, as she went backwards down the ladder. She tilted her head to watch how Mogget came down, but there was only the open trap door. A sarcastic meow under her feet announced that Mogget had once again managed to get between rooms without visible means of support.
"Ink and paper,"
the cat reminded her, jumping up onto the dragon desk.
"The thick paper. Smooth side up. Don't bother with a quill."
Sabriel followed Mogget's instructions, then watched with a resigned condescension that rapidly changed to surprise as the cat crouched by the square of paper, his strange shadow falling on it like a dark cloak thrown across sand, pink tongue out in concentration. Mogget seemed to think for a moment, then one bright ivory claw shot out from a white pad. He delicately inked the claw in the inkwell and began to draw. First, a rough outline in swift, bold strokes, the penning in of the major geographical features, then the delicate process of adding important sites, each named in fine, spidery writing. Last of all, Mogget marked Abhorsen's house with a small illustration, before leaning back to admire his handiwork and lick the ink from his paw. Sabriel waited a few seconds to be sure he was done, then cast drying sand over the paper, her eyes trying to absorb every detail, intent on learning the physical face of the old kingdom.
"You can look at it later," Mogget said,
after a few minutes, when his paw was clean. But Sabriel was still bent over the table, nose inches from the map.
"We're still in a hurry. You'd better go and get dressed for a start. Do try to be quick."
"I will," Sabriel smiled, still looking at the map.
"Thank you, Mogget."
The Sendings had laid out a great pile of clothes and equipment in Sabriel's room, and four of them were in attendance to help her get everything on and organized. She had hardly stepped outside before they'd stripped her indoor dress and slippers off, and she'd only just managed to remove her own underclothes before ghostly charter-traced hands tickled her sides. A few seconds later, she was suffering them anyway, as they pulled a thin, cotton-like undergarment over her head and a pair of baggy drawers up her legs. Next came a linen shirt, then a tunic of doeskin and breeches of supple leather, reinforced with some sort of hard, segmented plates at thighs, knees, and shins, not to mention a heavily padded bottom, no doubt designed for riding. A brief respite followed, lulling Sabriel into thinking that might be it, but the Sendings had merely been arranging the next layer for immediate fitting. Two of them pushed her arms into a long, armoured coat that buckled up at the sides, while the other two unlaced a pair of hobnailed boots and waited. The coat wasn't like anything Sabriel had ever worn before, including the male hauberk she'd worn in fighting arts lessons at school. It was as long as a hauberk, with split skirts coming down to her knees and sleeves swallow-tailed at her wrists, but it seemed to be entirely made of tiny overlapping plates, much like a fish's scales. They weren't metal, either, but some sort of ceramic, or even stone, much lighter than steel, but clearly very strong, as one Sending demonstrated by cutting down it with a dagger, striking sparks without leaving a scratch. Sabriel thought the boots completed the ensemble, but as the laces were done up by one pair of Sendings, the other pair were back in action. One raised what appeared to be a blue and silver striped turban, but Sabriel, pulling it down to just above her eyebrows, found it to be a cloth-wrapped helmet, made from the same material as the armor. The other Sending waved out a gleaming, deep blue surcoat, dusted with embroidered silver keys that reflected the light in all directions. It waved the coat to and fro for a moment, then whipped it over Sabriel's head and adjusted the drape with a practiced motion. Sabriel ran her hand over its silken expanse and discreetly tried to rip it in one corner, but for all its apparent fragility, it wouldn't tear. Last of all came sword belt and bell bandolier. The Sendings brought them to her, but made no attempt to put them on. Sabriel adjusted them herself, carefully arranging bells and scabbard, feeling the familiar weight, bells across her breast and sword balanced on her hip. She turned to the mirror and looked at her reflection, both pleased and troubled by what she saw. She looked competent, professional, a traveller who could look after herself. At the same time, she looked less like someone called Sabriel, and more like the Abhorsen, capital letter and all. She would have looked longer, but the Sendings tugged at her sleeves and directed her attention to the bed. A leather backpack lay open on it, and, as Sabriel watched, the Sendings packed it with her remaining old clothes, including her father's oilskin, spare undergarments, tunic and trousers, dried beef and biscuits, a water bottle, and several small leather pouches full of useful things, each of which were painstakingly opened and shown to her. Telescope, sulphur matches, clockwork fire starter, medicinal herbs, fishing hooks and line, a sewing kit, and a host of other small essentials. The three books from the library and the map went into oilskin pouches, and then into an outside pocket. Backpack on, Sabriel tried a few basic exercises, and was relieved to find that the armor didn't restrict her too much. Hardly at all, in fact, though the pack was not something she'd like to have on in a fight. She could even touch her toes, so she did, several times, before straightening up to thank the sendings. They were gone. Instead, there was Mogget, stalking mysteriously towards her from the middle of the room.
"Well, I'm ready," Sabriel said.
Mogget didn't answer, but sat at her feet and made a movement that looked very much like he was going to be sick. Sabriel recoiled, disgusted, then halted as a small metallic object fell from Mogget's mouth and bounced on the floor.
"Almost forgot," said Mogget. "You'll need this if I'm to come with you."
"What is it?" asked Sabriel, bending down to pick up a ring, a small silver ring with a ruby gripped between two silver claws that grew out of the band.
"Old," replied Mogget enigmatically. "You'll know if you need to use it. Put it on."
Sabriel looked at it closely, holding it between two fingers as she slanted it towards the light. It felt and looked quite ordinary. There were no outer marks on the stone or band. It seemed to have no emanations or aura. She put it on. It felt cold as it slipped down her finger, then hot. And suddenly she was falling into infinity, into a void that had no end and no beginning. Everything was gone, all light, all substance. Then charter marks suddenly exploded all around her, and she felt gripped by them, halting her headlong fall into nothing, accelerating her back up, back into her body, back to the world of life and death.
"Free magic," Sabriel said, looking down at the ring gleaming on her finger. "Free magic connected to the charter. I don't understand." "You'll know if you need to use it," Mogget repeated, almost as if it was some lesson to be learned by rote.
Then, in his normal voice,
"Don't worry about it till then. Come, the paper wing is ready."
Chapter 11. The paper wing sat on a jury-rigged platform of freshly sawn pine planks, teetering out over the eastern wall. Six sendings clustered around the craft, readying it for flight. Sabriel looked up at it as she climbed the stairs, an unpleasant feeling rising with her. She had been expecting something similar to the aircraft that had begun to be common in Anselstier, like the biplane that had performed aerobatics at the last Wyverley College open day. Something with two wings, rigging, and a propeller. Though she had assumed a magical engine rather than a mechanical one. But the paper wing didn't look anything like an Anselstieran airplane. It most closely resembled a canoe with hawk wings and a tail. On closer inspection, Sabriel saw that the central fuselage was probably based on a canoe. It was tapered at each end and had a central hole for a cockpit. Wings sprouted on each side of this canoe shape, long swept-back wings that looked very flimsy. The wedge-shaped tail didn't look much better. Sabriel climbed the last few steps with sinking expectations. The construction material was now clear, and so was the craft's name. The whole thing was made up from many sheets of paper, bonded together with some sort of laminate, painted powder blue, with silver bands around the fuselage and silver stripes along the wings and tail. It looked pretty, decorative, and not at all airworthy. Only the yellow falcon eyes, painted on its pointed prow, hinted at its capacity for flight. Sabriel looked at the paper wing again, and then out at the waterfall beyond. Now, fed by floodwaters, it looked even more frightening than usual. Spray exploded for tens of yards above its lip, a roaring mist the paper wing would have to fly through before it reached the open sky beyond. Sabriel didn't even know if it was waterproof.
"How often has this thing flown before?" she asked nervously.
Intellectually, she accepted that she would soon be sitting in this craft, to be launched out towards the crashing waters, but her subconscious and her stomach seemed very keen to stay firmly on the ground.
"Many times," replied Mogget, easily jumping from the platform to the cockpit.
His voice echoed there for a moment, till he climbed back up, furry cat face propped on the rim.
"The Abhorsen who made it once flew it to the sea and back in a single afternoon. But she was a great weather witch and could work the winds. I don't suppose..."
"No," said Sabriel, made aware of another gap in her education. She knew that wind magic was largely whistled charter marks, but that was all.
"No, I can't."
"Well,"
continued Mogget, after a thoughtful pause,
"the Paperwing does have some elementary charms to ride the wind. You'll have to whistle them, though."
"You can whistle, I trust."
Sabriel ignored him. All necromancers had to be musical, had to be able to whistle, to hum, to sing. If they were caught in death without bells or other magical instruments, their vocal skills were a weapon of last recourse. Ascending came and took her pack, helping her to wrestle it off, then stowing it at the rear of the cockpit. Another took Sabriel's arm and directed her to what appeared to be a leather half-hammock strung across the cockpit, obviously the pilot's seat. It didn't look terribly safe, either, but Sabriel forced herself to climb in, after giving her scabbarded sword into the hands of yet another sending. Surprisingly, her feet didn't go through the paper-laminated floor. The material even felt reassuringly solid, and after a minute of squirming, swaying, and adjustment, the hammock seat was very comfortable. Sword and scabbard were slid into a receptacle at her side, and Mogget took up a position on top of the straps, holding down her pack, just behind her shoulders, for the seat made her recline so far she was almost lying down. From her new eye level, Sabriel saw a small, oval mirror of silvered glass, fixed just below the cockpit rim. It glittered in the late afternoon sun, and she felt it resonate with charter magic. Something about it prompted her to breathe upon it, her hot breath clouding the glass. It stayed misted for a moment, then a charter mark slowly appeared, as if a ghostly finger was drawn across the clouded mirror. Sabriel studied it carefully, absorbing its purpose and effect. It told her of the marks that would follow, marks to raise the lifting winds, marks for descending in haste, marks to call the wind from every corner of the compass rose. There were other marks for the Paperwing, and, as Sabriel absorbed them, she saw that the whole craft was lined with charter magic, infused with spells. The Abhorsen who made it had labored long, and with love, to create something that was more like a magical bird than an aircraft. Time passed, and the last mark faded. The mirror cleared to be only a plate of silver glass shining in the sun. Sabriel sat, silent, fixing the charter marks in her memory, marveling at the power and the skill that had made the Paperwing, and had thought of this method of instruction. Perhaps one day she too would have the mastery to create such a thing. "The Abhorsen who made this," Sabriel asked, "who was she? I mean, in relation to me?"
"A cousin," purred Mogget, close to her ear. "Your great-great-great-great-grandmother's cousin. The last of that line. She had no children."
Maybe the Paperwing was her child, Sabriel thought, running her hand along the sleek surface of the fuselage, feeling the charter marks quiescent in the fabric. She felt a lot better about their forthcoming flight.
"We'd best hurry," Mogget continued. "It will be dark all too soon. Do you have the marks remembered?"
"Yes," replied Sabriel firmly. She turned to the sendings, who were now lined up behind the wings, anchoring the Paperwing till it was time for it to be unleashed upon the sky. Sabriel wondered how many times they'd performed this task, and for how many Abhorsens.
"Thank you," she said to them, "for all your care and kindness. Goodbye."
With that last word, she settled back in the hammock seat, gripped the rim of the cockpit with both hands, and whistled the notes of the lifting wind, visualizing the requisite string of charter marks in her mind, letting them drip down into her throat and lips, and out into the air. Her whistle sounded clear and true, and a wind rose behind to match it, growing stronger as Sabriel exhaled. Then, with a new breath, she changed to a merry, joyous trill. Like a bird reveling in flight, the charter marks flowing from pursed lips out into the paper wing itself. With this whistling, the blue and silver paint seemed to come alive, dancing down the fuselage, sweeping across the wings, a gleaming, lustrous plumage. The whole craft shook and shivered, suddenly flexible and eager to begin. The joyous trill ended with one single long clear note and a charter mark that shone like the sun. It danced to the paper wing's prow and sank into the laminate. A second later, the yellow eyes blinked, grew fierce and proud, looking up to the sky ahead. The sendings were struggling now, barely able to hold the paper wing back. The lifting wind grew stronger still, plucking at the silver-blue plumage, thrusting it forward. Sabriel felt the paper wing's tension, the contained power in its wings, the exhilaration of that last moment when freedom is assured. "Let go!" she cried, and the sendings complied, the paper wing leaping up into the arms of the wind, out and upward, splashing through the spray of the waterfall as if it were no more than a spring shower, flying out into the sky and the broad valley beyond. It was quiet and cold. 1,000 feet or more above the valley, the paper wing soared easily, the wind firm behind it, the sky clear above, save for the faintest wisps of cloud. Sabriel reclined in her hammock seat, relaxing, running the charter marks she'd learned over and over in her mind, making sure she had them properly pigeonholed. She felt free, and somehow clean, as if the dangers of the last few days were dirt, washed away by the following wind.
10 more to the north, Mogget's voice suddenly said behind her, disturbing her carefree mood. Do you recall the map?
Yes, replied Sabriel.
Shall we follow the river? The Rattlin, it's called, isn't it? It runs north-northeast most of the time.
Mogget didn't reply at once, though Sabriel heard his purring breath close by. He seemed to be thinking. Finally he said,
Why not? We may as well follow it to the sea. It branches into a delta there, so we can find an island to camp on tonight.
Why not just fly on? Asked Sabriel cheerily. We could be in Belisair by tomorrow night, if I summon the strongest winds.
The paper wing doesn't like to fly at night, Mogget said shortly. Not to mention that you would almost certainly lose control of the stronger winds. It is much more difficult than it seems at first. And the paper wing is much too conspicuous anyway. Have you no common sense, Abhorsen?
Call me Sabriel,
Sabriel replied equally shortly.
My father is Abhorsen. As you wish, mistress, said Mogget.
The mistress sounded extremely sarcastic.
The next hour passed in belligerent silence, but Sabriel, for her part, soon lost her anger in the novelty of flight. She loved the scale of it all, to see the tiny patchworked fields and forests below, the dark strip of the river, the occasional tiny building. Everything was so small and seemed so perfect, seen from afar. Then the sun began to sink, and though the red wash of its fading light made the aerial perspective even prettier, Sabriel felt the paper wing's desire to descend, felt the yellow eyes focusing on green earth, rather than blue sky. As the shadows lengthened, Sabriel felt that same desire, and began to look as well. The river was already breaking up into the myriad streams and rivulets that would form the swampy Rattlin Delta, and far off, Sabriel could see the dark bulk of the sea. There were many islands in the delta, some as large as football fields, covered with trees and shrubs, others no bigger than 2 armspans of mud. Sabriel picked out one of the medium-sized ones, a flattish diamond with low yellow grass,
a few leagues ahead, and whistled down the wind. It faded gradually with her whistle, and the paper wing began to descend, occasionally nudged this way or that by Sabriel's control of the wind, or its own tilt of a wing. Its yellow eyes and Sabriel's deep brown eyes were fixed on the ground below. Only Mogget, being Mogget, looked behind them and above. Even so, he didn't see their pursuers until they came wheeling out of the sun, so his yowling cry gave only a few seconds' warning, just long enough for Sabriel to turn and see the hundreds of fast-moving shapes diving down upon them. Instinctively, she conjured charter marks in her mind, mouth pursed, whistling the wind back up, turning them to the north.
"Gaw crows!" hissed Mogget,
as the flapping shapes checked their dive and wheeled to pursue their suddenly enlivened prey.
"Yes!" shouted Sabriel, though she wasn't sure why she answered. Her attention was all on the gaw crows, trying to gauge whether they'd intercept or not.
She could already feel the wind testing the edges of her control, as Mogget had prophesied, and to whip it up further might have unpleasant results. But she could also feel the presence of the gaw crows, feel the admixture of death and free magic that gave life to their rotten, skeletal forms. Gaw crows didn't last very long in sun and wind. These must have been made the previous night. A necromancer had trapped quite ordinary crows, killing them with ritual and ceremony, before infusing the bodies with the broken, fragmented spirit of a single dead man or woman. Now they were truly carrion birds, birds guided by a single, if stupid, intelligence. They flew by force of free magic, and killed by force of numbers. Despite her quickness in calling the wind, the flock was still closing rapidly. They dived from high above and kept their speed, the wind stripping feathers and putrid flesh from their spell-woven bones. For a moment, Sabriel considered turning the paper wing back into the very center of this great murder of crows, like an avenging angel armed with sword and bells. But there were simply too many gaw crows to fight, particularly from an aircraft speeding along several hundred feet above the ground. One over-eager sword thrust would mean a fatal fall if the gaw crows didn't kill her on the way down.
"I'll have to summon a greater wind," she yelled at Mogget,
who was now sitting right up on her pack, fur bristling, yowling challenges at the crows. They were very close now, flying in an eerily exact formation, two long lines, like arms outstretched to snatch the fleeing paper wing from the sky. Very little of their once black plumage had survived their rushing dive, white bone shining through in the last light of the sun. But their beaks were still glossily black and gleaming sharp, and Sabriel could now see the red glints of the fragmented dead spirit in the empty sockets of their eyes. Mogget didn't reply. Possibly he hadn't even heard her above his yowling and the gaw crows cawing as they closed the last few yards to attack, a strange, hollow sound, as dead as their flesh. For a second of panic, Sabriel felt her dry lips unable to purse. Then she wet them, and the whistle came, slow and erratic. The charter marks felt clumsy and difficult in her head, as if she were trying to push a heavy weight on badly made rollers. Then, with a last effort, they came easily, flowing into her whistled notes. Unlike her earlier gradual summonings, this wind came with the speed of a slamming door, howling up behind them with frightening violence, picking up the paper wing and shunting it forward like a giant wave lifting up a slender boat. Suddenly they were going so fast that Sabriel could barely make out the ground below, and the individual islands of the delta merged into one continuous blur of motion. Eyes closed to protective slits, she craned her head around, the wind striking her face like a vicious slap. The pursuing gaw crows were all over the sky now, formation lost, like small black stains against the red and purple sunset. They were flapping uselessly, trying to come back together, but the paper wing was already a league or more away. There was no chance they could catch up. Sabriel let out a sigh of relief, but it was a sigh tempered with new anxieties. The wind was carrying them at a fearful pace, and it was starting to veer northwards, which it wasn't supposed to do. Sabriel could see the first stars twinkling now, and they were definitely turning towards the buckle. It was an effort to call up the charter marks again and whistle the spell to ease the wind and turn it back to the east, but Sabriel managed to cast it. But the spell failed to work. The wind grew stronger and shifted more, till they were careening straight towards the buckle, directly north. Sabriel, hunkered down in the cockpit, eyes and nose streaming and face frozen, tried again, using all her willpower to force the charter marks into the wind. Even to her, her whistle sounded feeble, and the charter marks once again vanished into what had now become a gale. Sabriel realized she had totally lost control. In fact, it was almost as if the spell had the opposite effect, for the wind grew wilder, snatching the paperwing up in a great spiral, like a ball thrown between a ring of giants, each one taller than the last. Sabriel grew dizzy and even colder, and her breath came fast and shallow, trying to salvage enough air to keep her alive. She tried to calm the winds again, but couldn't gain the breath to whistle, and the charter marks slipped from her mind, till all she could do was desperately hang on to the straps in the hammock seat as the paperwing tried its best to ride the storm. Then, without warning, the wind ceased its upward dance. It just dropped, and with it went the paperwing. Sabriel fell upwards, straps suddenly tight, and Mogget almost clawed through the pack in his efforts to stay connected with the aircraft. Jolted by this new development, Sabriel felt her exhaustion burn away. She tried to whistle the lifting wind, but it too was beyond her power. The paperwing seemed unable to halt its headlong descent. It fell, nose tilting further and further forward, till they were diving almost vertically, like a hammer rushing to the anvil of the ground below. It was a long way down. Sabriel screamed once, then tried to put some of her fear-found strength into the paperwing. But the marks flowed into her whistle without effect, save for a golden sparkle that briefly illuminated her white, wind-frozen face. The sun had completely set, and the dark mass of the ground below looked all too much like the grey river of death, the river their spirits would cross into in a few short minutes, never to return to the warm light of life.
"Loose my collar,"
mewed a voice at Sabriel's ear, followed by the curious sensation of Mogget digging his claws into her armor as he clambered into her lap.
"Loose my collar."
Sabriel looked at him, at the ground, at the collar. She felt stupid, starved of oxygen, unable to decide. The collar was part of an ancient binding, a terrible guardian of tremendous power. It would only be used to contain an inexpressible evil or uncontrollable force.
"Trust me,"
howled Mogget.
"Loose my collar and remember the ring."
Sabriel swallowed, closed her eyes, fumbled with the collar, and prayed that she was doing the right thing. "Father, forgive me," she thought. But it was not just to her father that she spoke, but to all the Abhorsens who had come before her, especially the one who had made the collar so long ago. Surprisingly for such an ancient spell, she felt little more than pins and needles as the collar came free. Then it was open, and suddenly heavy, like a lead rope or a ball and chain. Sabriel almost dropped it, but it became light again, then insubstantial. When Sabriel opened her eyes, the collar had simply ceased to exist. Mogget sat still on her lap and seemed unchanged. Then he seemed to glow with an internal light and expand till he became frayed at the edges, and the light grew and grew. Within a few seconds there was no cat shape left, just a shining blur too bright to look at. It seemed to hesitate for a moment, and Sabriel felt its attention flicker between aggression towards her and some inner struggle. It all and expand till he became frayed at the edges, and the light grew and grew. Within a few seconds there was no cat shape left, just a shining blur too bright to look at. It seemed to hesitate for a moment, and Sabriel felt its attention flicker between aggression towards her and some inner struggle. It almost formed back into the cat shape again, then suddenly split into four shafts of brilliant white. One shot forward, one aft, and two seemed to slide into the